Good afternoon. I'm Mark Sell. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm filling in for Todd Wilkin this week. Todd is on vacation, having a good time with his family, I'm sure. And I'm thankful Todd has asked me to fill in. Today, we're going to be, for the next hour, we're going to start out with Dr. Adolf Harsted. He is the professor of Old Testament theology at Bethany Lutheran Seminary, and we're going to talk about Joshua. It'll be part three of a four-part series. In the second half of this hour, beginning at 5:30, we will be talking to Wesley Smith. He's going to give us an update on the euthanasia case of Terry Schindler Schiavo. That's the case in Florida that's been so controversial, where Governor Bush has had to chime in the past. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about human cloning, if we have time. But right now, we're going to go ahead and turn to our guest, Dr. Adolf Harsted. Dr. Harsted, how are you today?
I'm just fine. Thank you, Mark.
Well, it's great to talk to you. I've heard a lot about your book. I'm kind of one of the guys who was in the background, if you will, working with Chris Mitchell and Julene Dumit over there at CPH.
Wonderful people to work with, by the way.
No, they're great people. I'm very thankful for them. I sit in awe of their gifts and how they work with all the authors such as yourself. And I know they did a good job on editing your book, but most importantly, you handed in a wonderful book about the Old Testament, the book of Joshua, which happens to be the Issues Etc. book of the month for February. And that commentary on Joshua was fascinating. I've been going through it. I read it a little bit about a year ago, and then just went through it again since its current release. And one of the things that I think is fascinating is when you think of the Old Testament, and especially when you start pouring through some of these books and all this old information, whether it be about temples or tabernacles or the tent of meeting, and oh my goodness, geography. What does geography have to do with anything, especially Jesus who died on the cross? And I think your book just does a wonderful job of pointing to Christ. Even in these chapters that we're going to be discussing today, chapters 13 through 21. But first, can you help me understand a little bit, and for our listeners, a little bit, how can Joshua talk about Jesus so clearly? And as you explain that, then move it towards chapter 13 through 21.
Okay. Thank you for the compliments, first of all.
My pleasure.
As I'm talking to you, by the way, I'm looking out the window across the Minnesota River Valley over toward the west to North Mankato, where I live. And it is very similar to the scene that Joshua must have had looking over the River Jordan into the Promised Land. So I got to get a picture right out my window here of things that went on in Israel, 1400 B.C.
Well, that's sure handy.
Yeah. Now, how does geography relate to Jesus? And that's a great question. You probably haven't heard too many sermons on the border stages of the various tribes of Israel.
No.
But hopefully some people will preach on these verses after they study Joshua a little bit more. First of all, all this mention of geography points out that these things happened in the real world, at a real time, at a real place, namely Old Testament Canaan in about 1400 B.C. So that's important for us to know, that this is not some fairy tale, ethereal, never-never-land stuff, but real world, real history. Geography certainly brings that out, as all these names are mentioned. And you can go to the land of Israel today, as many have and as I have, and walk on the ground at some of these places.
So first of all, you'd say it's real history. This is real life. Okay, good.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
And then, of course, the real meaning of that land comes in at this point, that Jesus is the ultimate heir of that land. The promise to Abraham said that one of Abraham's seed was going to inherit this land. It's Paul that brings out that clearly in Galatians 3:15 and 16, where he says it doesn't say seeds are going to inherit that land, but one seed, which is Jesus. So Jesus would walk on that land. Jesus would live the perfect life on that land for us. His cross would be sunk into the ground at a place called Jerusalem, at a site called Golgotha in that land. He would rise from one of the tombs of that land. He would ascend into heaven from one of the mountains of that land. So, I mean, the land is wrapped up in Jesus. It's his land for the sake of the salvation of the world. Another important thing to remember is the word inheritance in this regard. This was Israel's inheritance. Each tribe gets its inheritance. That word appears again and again and again in the book of Joshua. And this is, of course, a reminder of a greater inheritance through Jesus for us. As the testator of the new covenant, he gives us our eternal inheritance, and he will say at the last day to the believers, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundations of the world.
Okay, so in other words, let me see if this makes sense. Correct me if I'm wrong. So in other words, the historicity then translates into the reality that, you know, Jesus also was history. Jesus also walked this land, and these are the lands that Jesus walked, and frankly, it's the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Old Testament as well, the promises of God to the children of Israel. Does that sound right?
Exactly right.
Okay, great. Great. Well, that sure helps. I know as I was preparing for this, I was reading especially these chapters over again, and I have to say, it was great to go through them again because it did bring those kinds of thoughts out. So I sure appreciate the work that you've done on that. Now, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say thanks.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. Now, in chapters 13 to 21, can you give me just a quick general overview of what takes place in that section as a whole?
Yes. First of all, some of these chapters are kind of given bookends. And the two bookends at the beginning and near the end are accounts of the two faithful spies, Caleb and Joshua, who each get their land inheritance. Literary term for such a thing is inclusio, but it's really nothing but bookends, bracketing these chapters. So faithful Caleb gets his land first. And then at the end of the distribution to the tribes comes faithful Joshua's land given. And so this gives us this wonderful picture. When people trust in God's promises, then they receive the gifts of God freely, as Caleb and Joshua did. So that's the way these chapters are bracketed. And then we have the individual tribes getting their land in 14 through 19. Mm-hmm. And so we go tribe by tribe, including the land that had already been given by Moses on the other side of the Jordan River. That comes across, first of all, after the distribution to Caleb, as a kind of review that Moses had already given this land to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan River. And then comes the rest of the tribes, starting with Judah and so forth, and right down the list of the 12 tribes. And then the last two chapters that you referred to in that section, they consist of, first of all, cities of refuge in chapter 20,
mm-hmm.
where people who had accidentally murdered people could run and find refuge and safety. And then, finally, chapter 21, the end of this section, lists the 48 cities of the Levites. The Levites did not get any tribal land as such. But that doesn't mean that they were forgotten by God. They got cities throughout the land and could then be teachers of the covenant throughout the land of Canaan. So that kind of gives an outline of,
sure.
of 13 to 21.
Well, that's very helpful because what we do is I'd like to get that big picture, if you will, and then kind of go after a couple things within that big picture. So that was very helpful. Thank you. One of the things that... that really hit me, and I enjoyed reading through again, was in the section 19:10 through 16 in that area. It's page 603, in case you were following along there.
Okay.
But it was this whole talk of Nazareth and its relationship to Jesus and the language, you know, the Hebrew words and the roots and those kinds of things, you know, the whole branch talk. Can you just run us through that a little bit? Because I just thought that was fascinating.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The portion of the land that Jesus would have grown up in is in the tribal allotment of Zebulun. So he grows up up on the hilltop there. It's a beautiful sight, by the way, if you've been to Israel. You stand up at Nazareth and you look out across the broad Jezreel Valley, and you can just drink in the history that went on in this panoramic view. That means that Jesus could view this history, too, as he spent the early years of his life there in the carpenter shop and so forth in, mm-hmm. in Nazareth. Nazareth, once again in the tribe of Zebulun, so Jesus springs up from the ground of Israel in that area, and the word Nazareth seems to have the root Nazar, which means branch, and so Jesus, the branch from King David, grows up in Branch City, so that we might be the fruit on the tree that he produces through his death and resurrection and rising.
Okay. Boy, that's something. Because I don't think a lot of people catch that the connection of that root, you know, that Nazar, that the whole idea of the root and the root of Jesse and those kinds of things. I have to say, when I was reading through that, right away Christmas came to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and some of the hymns that we sing at Christmas that speak about that, and the prophecies from Isaiah. Could you just talk a little bit about that one prophecy and of Isaiah? A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his root shall blossom.
Yes, there are several terms that all relate to that picture. You know, the root, the branch, and so forth, and. Once again, that connection is kind of neat, that the word Nazareth comes from that same root. So we got the sure prophecies given at various times. By the way, Isaiah comes in kind of midpoint between Joshua's allotment here in the book of Joshua and the time when Jesus would arrive on the scene. This allotment about 1400 B.C., Isaiah giving his prophecies, one of which we just talked about 700 B.C., and then Jesus arriving on the scene, of course, about 700 years later.
Hmm.
So God does not leave people empty of promises in Old Testament times. Those people needed the sure hope that you and I look back upon to see the work of Jesus.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks. I appreciate that. Let's now another question I had, and I thought was kind of interesting, is reading through, going back to around page 581 in Joshua 18, 1 through 10 in that section, and this whole idea of Shiloh comes up, and what that meant to the children of Israel and the tabernacle and those kinds of things, and it links it to the presence of God. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it relates to eschatology?
All right. Shiloh was the name of a city, of course, and it becomes a site for dividing up the rest of the land, as you've pointed out there in chapter 18. But Shiloh is also used in a number of other Old Testament passages. The question sometimes is exactly what does it mean? And it seems to mean what belongs to him, so that Jesus is the one to whom the kingdom belongs. All things finally belong to him. And now we have this name, Shiloh, as the city at which the distribution is given. And, of course, it's through Jesus giving the inheritance that we all receive our eternal inheritance. So it's through Shiloh, the Messiah, that we receive our inheritance, even as the Old Testament people received at Shiloh their inheritance of ground, or earthly ground, which, of course, prefigures the the new heavens and the new earth.
Okay. Now, what is the in the commentary section here, you make the point that at Shiloh, Israel sets up the Tent of Meeting of Tabernacle. What's the significance at the tent about the Tent of Meeting or the Tabernacle?
Well, it's the place, of course, where God agreed to show his presence. With the tabernacle is the Ark of the Covenant. That played a very prominent part earlier on in the book of Joshua in chapters 3 and 4 at the crossing of the Jordan, where the Lord, through the presence of that vehicle of his presence, the Ark of the Covenant, shows that he is leading his nation across the river. He's in the thick of the things for his people. He's not going to abandon them, neither leave you nor forsake you, he promises. Once again, that Ark of the Covenant is within the tabernacle and certainly signifies God's gracious presence among his people. Finally, he's the one who carries out the distribution of the land. Yes, he does it through his agents, Joshua, Eliezer, and so forth, but finally, it is God controlling the lot, which gives the individual tribes their land. And that the presence of that tabernacle then would bring that out, that God is in control of the inheritance. He gives it up.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. We're talking to Dr. Adolf Harsted. He's a professor of Old Testament theology at Bethany Lutheran Seminary. He's the author of this month's Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, The Concordia Commentary on Joshua. This is part three of a four-part series. I'm Mark Sell. I'm sitting in for the vacationing Todd Wilkin. And we're going over Joshua chapters 13 through 21 with Dr. Harsted. And in about 10 minutes from now, we'll be talking to Wesley Smith. And the topic coming up at 5:30 will be euthanasia and the case of Terry Schindler Schiavo. And if we have time, we'll also talk a little bit about human cloning. That's coming up at 5:30. But before then, we're going to continue with Dr. Harsted on he wrote the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. And we just got done talking a little bit about the tabernacle and the importance of Shiloh. And the tabernacle really was a fascinating thing to realize for the children of Israel, because it really signified it was the presence of God on earth, wasn't it? Is that a fair way to state it?
That's a fair way of saying it. Right. Of course, it leads up to the construction of the temple.
Right.
And the location of the temple at Jerusalem, which the book of Ezekiel says is at the center of the nations. And so it leads then to also the place where the great high priest would sacrifice himself for the sins of the world at Jerusalem.
Well, that's good, because I think one of the things that we always have to keep connected to the presence of God on earth, I mean, that's such a comforting thought, but it's comforting only if you could taste of his grace and forgiveness so you don't get killed in his presence.
Yeah.
So that's pretty important to keep that forgiveness and grace there, and you pointed that out earlier. So good for you. I appreciate that. Now I would like to turn to the whole idea of eschatology, the last things and the last day. Can you say a little bit about how this section, what portions of this section might refer to eschatology, to last things or the last day, or how it might point us to that?
Okay, we've mentioned that word inheritance, and as soon as we hear that word once again, we think about the great final last day when believers can lift up their heads and rejoice because their redemption draws near. And what's going to happen on that last day? Well, just as the 12 tribes received from God their free inheritance, which they did not earn by their labors, but which God freely gave them, so likewise Jesus will say, inherit the kingdom prepared for you. So certainly any talk about inheritance in the Old Testament puts our minds on that last day. Eschatology, of course, coming from the Greek eschatos, meaning the end or end times. So just as this is kind of near the end of the book of Joshua, so that end of the book of Joshua reminds us of end times, the end of our own lives, whenever that might be. and the end of the old earth as we know it, and the inheritance in the new heavens and the new earth.
Okay, now we've got about probably about 4 minutes left, Dr. Harstad, and what I want to do is turn a little bit to what you had mentioned earlier, and this idea of a place of respite or a place of sanctuary in chapter 20, and the way you wrote about it in your commentary, it talks about the ministry of Christ and the grace and that gracious opportunity to be safe somewhere. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you're referring to the six cities of refuge.
Okay.
And they're distributed rather evenly throughout the land. On the west side, they are Hebron, Shechem, and Kedesh. And on the east side of the River Jordan, they are Bezer and Ramoth-Gilead and Golan. Now that means that within a couple of hours, somebody who had inadvertently killed someone and whose own life was in danger now from somebody who might be chasing after him could run to one of those six cities and be guaranteed safety within those cities. And it's a beautiful picture of God being our refuge and our strength. The words of the liturgy come back to our minds probably. We flee for refuge to your infinite mercy, Lord. So those cities are also a wonderful picture of being under the wings of our Savior God, whose blood made our eternal rescue sure, and we find our rest, our refuge in him alone, even as they could find rest in these six cities of refuge.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Harstad. We sure appreciate you coming on and talking to us and talking about your book. It's always exciting to be able to turn to the Old Testament and hear about Jesus Christ when many times people sometimes miss that connection, and your commentary does a wonderful job of how showing even things like geography of the Old Testament point to Jesus Christ, and it's such a blessing to the church. So thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, that was Dr. Harstad. He was the author of the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. This was part three of a four-part series. We're looking forward to talking to Dr. Harstad for part four on the Book of Joshua. And what we'd like to do is remind you that you could find out more about the Concordia Commentary on Joshua on our website. That's issuesetc.org. Again, our website, you could learn more about Concordia Commentary on Joshua on our website of issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekday during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040, and ask about the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Again, that's from Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. Well, we've got an exciting guest coming up, a very hot topic. It's an update. We're going to get an update from Wesley Smith on the euthanasia case of Terry Schindler Schiavo.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
In the Old Testament book of Joshua, God commands Joshua and the armies of Israel to completely drive out and destroy their Canaanite enemies. How can a God of love demand war and killing? You'll find an answer to this question in the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Or order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Call any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. The website address again, issuesetc.org, or 1-800-325-3040.
The Church. Going, going, gone?
Answers with Ken Ham.
an international speaker on the authority and accuracy of the Bible. Well, Ken, I've heard reports that church attendance in England, where I lived for a while, has been declining. But the church there, is it really gone?
Well, you know, following years of declining church attendance, the Church of England paints a very bleak picture. It says most people would rather spend time with family, renovating their home, or watching sports. And the church went on to say, the reality is that mainstream culture no longer brings people to the church door. Now, this report recognizes that the increasing ignorance of the basic Christian tenets will make it even harder to attract people to British churches. It reported that, quote, during the 20th century, Sunday school attendance dropped from 55% to 4% of children, meaning that even the rudiments of the Christian story and Christian experience are lacking in most young people, end of quote. One of the major reasons for this decline in Britain is because the church gave up a literal Genesis and accepted millions of years along with Darwinian evolution. And the results of this compromise can be seen in the dying culture. To revitalize the church, the leaders need to return to believing God's word from the very first verse, but not just in England, around the world.
One of the most popular free booklets that our Answers Ministry offers is the one by Ken Ham about why a loving God allows death and suffering in this world. So find it on our website at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Advertisers will use many tricks to make their product appealing. One of the most frequently used methods is called glamorization. Whether it is an ad in a magazine or a commercial on TV, it will show well-dressed or sometimes scantily dressed, beautiful models that are using the product. The potential customer is then expected to think, yes, I want to be like that. I'll use that product. Ralph Lauren commercials are masters at this type of glamorization. Help your children to see through this kind of ruse. Since God loved them enough to send Jesus to die for them, He certainly loves them enough to give them the wisdom they need to see through such ads. One way He gives them such wisdom is through parental instruction. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Hey, Chuck, how you doing?
Paul, not so well.
Oh, why? What's up?
Well, first, the Boston Red Sox beat the Cardinals 4 straight in the World Series.
Yeah, what could be worse than that?
I'll tell you what's worse. An internet listener from Boston solved the Bible quiz on the second day.
You know, it looks like you're on your way to another F from Johnny this week.
I feel low.
Kind of takes you back to when the Patriots beat the Rams.
You know, Paul, you really know how to brighten a guy's day.
The AM 850 KFUO Bible quiz, now being solved prematurely by people all over the United States.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Mark Sell. I'm sitting in for the vacationing Todd Wilkin. We are live here today. It's Thursday, February the 17th, and we've got an exciting guest here, Wesley Smith. Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's also authored several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. And we're going to talk to him about the Terry Schindler Schiavo case in Florida. Welcome back to the show, Wesley.
Thank you very much, Mark. Good talking to you.
Likewise. Well, tell us, what's going on? Give us an update on what's happening there in Florida.
Well, it's very depressing and very outrageous. In Florida, in my view, addiction to legal process is overcoming justice. That is, so much information has come out about Terry's situation and the behavior of her ex-husband. I call him ex because he's had 2 children by another woman with whom he's lived for 8 or 9 years now. So if that isn't the abandonment of a marriage, I don't know what is. But about him, since the original trial in the Schiavo case, but the courts will not allow all of that to come in a new trial. They're, in essence, hanging legal process around Terry's neck like a millstone. And apparently it looks like he's going to be dehydrated to death beginning February 22nd.
Oh, my. I know it's really been a long process. Just to, if you could, to remind our listeners, how long has this been going on?
Well, the Terry was injured in around 1990, as I recall. In 1991 or 92, Michael Schiavo, I think 92, sued for medical malpractice to get a lot of money for that collapse. He obtained more than $1 million, $750,000 of which was to be used to take care of Terry. As soon as that money was in the bank, he suddenly said, and he had told that original malpractice jury that she would live a normal lifespan, that he would spend the rest of his and her life taking care of her. As soon as the money was in the bank, he suddenly decided, he remembered suddenly that she wouldn't want to live like this and started to refuse medical treatment such as antibiotics. In 1998, he decided to have her feeding tube pulled, and that lawsuit's been going on with her parents ever since.
Okay. Boy, that was a convenient memory on his part.
Oh, yeah. Suddenly he had a new realization when he would have inherited all that money. What's really depressing is that money was supposed to be used, and the malpractice jury was told it would be used to care for her medical needs, to give her testing and rehabilitation, but none of that money went to that. It all went to lawyers to make her dead.
Oh, that's a shame. That really is. Now, earlier you stated that this was like a millstone. The legal process has become a millstone around her neck. What exactly recently happened that makes this such a sad turn of events?
Well, the courts overturned Terry's law, which supposedly would have permitted the governor of Florida from intervening in cases such as Terry, where there was no written advance directive and where there was a family dispute to prevent dehydrations. And also the court is refusing to acknowledge that Terry was a devout and is a devout Catholic, and that the Pope came out very strongly to state that in cases like hers, you were not to take away food and water. And thus the point of a motion was that forcing her to be dehydrated to death violates her religious beliefs. But the courts threw that out, and also the courts refused to kick Michael Schiavo out as guardian, even though, as I said, he's been with another woman for 8 years, has two kids by her. And never let her have a guardian ad litem except for 1 month, and when the guardian ad litem said don't dehydrate her, the guardian ad litem was rejected. She never had her own lawyer, and the courts have said that doesn't matter. There have been times when Michael was allowed by Judge Greer not to abide by the law to have a guardianship plan in place. The irregularities in this case, are profound, and I've written quite a bit about it. If people want to get more details, they should go to my website, www.wesleyjsmith.com. Go to the article section and look for the Schiavo articles, www.wesleyjsmith.com.
Well, thanks. I appreciate getting that word out, because there are a lot of good columns there that you have, including this topic. And this really is a sad case, because it's something that is that happens more frequently, I think, than what people realize.
It happens in all 50 states, Mark. In all 50 states, people with cognitive disabilities who would not die except for the fact that they can't swallow are being denied food and water, both conscious and unconscious alike. And people are just, it's almost like they don't want to see it. And it's just deemed medical treatment, and if anybody says anything, well, you're interfering with these intimate decisions. Yet there's something else going on in bioethics called futile care theory, F-U-T-I-L-E, which if it comes into being, and hospitals are putting in these protocols, some of them around the country now, would permit doctors to refuse to give people like Terry food and water if the doctor doesn't think their life is worth living. So what we have going on here is the creation of a disposable caste, C-A-S-T-E, of people. We have a diminution, a restricting of the number of humans that the society will fully protect. And it's happening, and the progressives are supposedly in favor of it, and yet progressives and liberals are supposed to care for weak and defenseless people. But I don't see that happening here, except in the disability rights community, which are some of the most adamant foes of dehydrating people like Terry to death.
Wow. I tell you, it really is something that is pretty close to my heart. I was a hospice chaplain for 6 years in Utah.
Well, good for you. And I've been a hospice volunteer and am a hospital lay chaplain right now, so I know what that's like.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear that, because hospice really has an incredible role that it can play in people's life as they, you know, as the end comes near.
And Terry's not dying, though. Realize that if she isn't denied food and water, she's not dying and shouldn't be in a hospital.
Right, right. That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. And one of the things I was going to comment on is I often saw this where you had doctors who were pushing family members towards this end because they knew once you withdraw, I mean, withdrawing food is one thing in nourishment, but once you withdraw the water, then you could pretty much say how many days it's going to be, you know, within a day or two.
Mark, if they took you and I, stuck us in a room, locked the door for 2 weeks, we'd die also if you took away our food and water.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to be sick to die from taking away food and water. That's a need for anybody to have.
Right. I tell you, it was a real battle that that I faced often with many different situations. I would even come across where I'd be walking through the hospital and I'd be recognized because I had my collar on, and people would pull me inside and just say, you know, the doctor's advising me to do this, Reverend. What should I do? And I was just stunned how often that happened. That was a rude awakening. And I think it's something people really need to be aware of, because it is a slippery slope. Once we start looking at cases like Terry's, there really is no end once you want to take this to its logical conclusion.
Well, I agree with that, and I think the people who need to be educated the most are pastors, because often parishioners come into pastors' studies to get some advice in these very difficult situations, and pastors are completely unaware of how medical ethics are changing. They're completely unaware that the bioethics movement is doing away with Hippocratic values and turning medical ethics into a utilitarian system. And it's extremely dangerous, and the attack on the sanctity of human life in this country, particularly those of the weakest and most vulnerable among us, is epidemic.
Right, and I think one of the things that that becomes obvious when a person gets involved in this is the finances, really, that end up driving hospitals to develop policies, even in these issues. As much as they deny it, they still struggle with it, because you simply have the bottom line that they've got to face if they're trying to help people along these lines.
Well, that's
true. Frustrating.
That's true, and particularly, you know, it takes a long time for people's awareness to catch up to their impressions. 20 years ago, people who were very ill were profit makers for hospitals. Intensive care units were profit makers for hospitals, because we had what was called fee-for-service medicine. That is, every time a doctor or a hospital provided a service, they get paid for it. But that changed because our health care system was going broke. We now have managed care, capitated systems. That means a hospital, for example, in Medicare, if a sick person, elderly person on Medicare goes into a hospital, that hospital gets one lump sum payment. And if that person stays beyond the time in the hospital that payment covers, the loss is on the hospital.
So if I may, just to make sure our listeners understand this, is that here's a lump sum, and basically you've got to budget this out over the life of this person.
That's right.
And if this person outlives the budget, too bad.
You lose money. And the same thing is true with HMOs, who pay hospitals a blank dollars to take care of the HMO patients. And if you end up with a patient in the hospital that's in intensive care unit for 3 weeks, that hospital's losing its shirt, proverbial shirt. But people still think that the hospital's making money, and they still think the incentive is to hook people up to machines against their will, when now the economic incentive is to cut off care.
Oh, my. Well, I'll tell you, I really loved my time as a hospice chaplain and working in medical settings. And I think this was the thing that was the most frustrating to deal with, is having to be respectful of the medical community for what they could do and still have to help draw the lines and bring in the ethics boards and committees to really try to draw some lines.
Well, except the people on the ethics boards tend to be utilitarian bioethicists or trained by them.
Right, right. No, exactly.
It's like you have to get people who understand Hippocratic values and the sanctity of human life on these committees, but often I've talked to people, for example, who are pro-life, who get on these committees and they get kicked off.
Yeah, no, I believe it. It was one of the things I had to do. I eventually then did serve on the ethics board of the hospital in St. George there, Utah, and one of the things that I had to be very careful about was how I spoke about these things, so I could stay on without being discriminated eventually because I was going to hurt things if I spoke too much about...
You were going to throw a monkey wrench into the utilitarian gears.
Oh, right, right. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking with Wesley Smith. He's the attorney for International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. And he is also the author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. We've been talking, he's been updating us on the euthanasia case of Terry Schindler Schiavo. This is Issues Etc. You're listening to Mark Sell. I'm filling in for Todd Wilkin this week. Todd's on vacation. And what I'd like to do now, Wesley, is kind of shift the conversation over to the topic of human cloning and some of the bizarre things that are going on. It really is a continuum of that other discussion because we're talking about the sanctity of life, the value of life, the importance of who a human being is, what it means to be a person. And I was reading some of your articles, and one of them I thought, you know, you'd like to introduce it to people and say, so which horror movie do you think you're watching when you hear about, let's experiment and take the brain of a human being and put that brain inside a mouse and let's see what happens. You know, it's so bizarre, the things that are going on that I read in some of your articles, but these are really happening.
They're either really happening or really proposed and seriously proposed. What I think your audience, I hope they will understand after this conversation, is that biotech has become incredibly radical and that cloning is moving forward at like a train out of control going down a mountain. You know, a lot of people, when they think of, for example, stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, they still think it's only about, and I'm putting only in quotes, but only about leftover embryos that are remaining from in vitro fertilization treatments that are going to be thrown out anyway. That's what we first talked about 4 years ago when President Bush was asked to fund embryonic stem cell research. But those days, I mean, they are so long gone, even though the New York Times won't report it yet, and most of the mainstream media won't report it yet, and any time that they attempt to legalize human cloning, they talk about it as if it's just stem cell research. But they are so long gone that people are not even closely aware of what's happening. Let me give you an example. New Jersey has legalized cloning, human cloning through somatic cell nuclear transfer. That's the procedure used to make Dolly the sheep. Implantation of cloned embryos, because cloning does not make stem cells. Cloning makes embryos. That's the science. Into wombs, and they did that by not outlawing it, so that which is not against law is legal. And literally legalized gestation of cloned fetuses through the ninth month, only requiring that these fetuses be destroyed the moment just prior to birth. And I've written about that. People can look at my book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. It's in there. And also my articles, again, at WesleyJSmith.com.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Let me go on.
Yeah,
you might think that that was a mistake. That has also been tried in other states. Illinois, it failed by only one vote. Maryland, Delaware, and Texas. And right now, today, and if people go to my blog, WesleyJSmith.com/blog, I've just discovered this week that Washington State has a bill pending that would permit cloning through the ninth month. And I wrote about that in National Review Online, which you can access at my website or at my blog. And just today, Mark, I discovered that Minnesota has a bill pending that would allow cloning through the ninth month, which I just blogged on. So the idea that stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, is only about leftover in vitro fertilization embryos is, of course, and completely false. And the idea that it's even only about early embryos left in petri dishes is false. What is being prepared, and I'm not kidding, even though they cannot yet do it technologically, is fetal farming. These laws and legislations that are going into effect are preparing the way for fetal farming. And there is...
Wesley, let me interrupt you for a second there. I mean, when you say fetal farming...
I mean it literally.
It sounds like we're, you know, let's herd these cattle, let's herd these, you know, the fetus and have them lined up and...
they are creating laws that would permit natural and cloned embryos to be implanted in real or artificial wombs and gestated for periods of time for various reasons and then destroyed. They're also creating a category of life, not which can be destroyed, but which must be destroyed, which is one of the most radical notions in the history of humankind. And these things are going to be, these fetal farming will be used for drug testing, to procure organs, possibly, to learn how to genetically engineer, to learn how to engage in reproductive cloning, because before you can do reproductive cloning, you have to be able to do safe cloning. That is, cloning that would be done so that there aren't birth defects. The only way to do that is to make clone after clone after clone and test different techniques and then abort them and check them out to see if they've been they're being developing normally and so forth. These laws would permit these very kinds of, and the legislation, for example, in Washington and Minnesota today would permit these very kinds of awful, immoral, scientific research reducing human life to a category of natural resource and a corn crop to be harvested, and the mainstream media won't report on it. But there's no denying it if you read the legislation, which I have. I've analyzed it, and I posted it on my blog and on my website. This is radical, out-of-control biotech that has no intention of being limited in any reasonable way at all.
Boy, that is amazing, and I think people just... people are having a hard time grasping.
They don't believe it.
Well, Mark, right. Yeah.
They don't believe it, and I don't blame them, but it's in black and white. People had better start thinking and believing and acting, because if they don't stand up and say, wait a minute, we don't want to go down this road, the mainstream media will never tell you.
Right, right. And, well, it is such a hideous plot, if you will, behind the PR. I think most people, when they think of stem cell research, they're still pretty emotional about President Reagan and how he might have been helped.
And guess what?
And that's the end of what they're thinking.
That's a fantasy, too.
Right.
Of all the types of diseases that could be helped with stem cells, Alzheimer's is one of the last ones. In fact, in a wonderful... exception to the rule that the mainstream media just does a terrible job reporting these issues. The Washington Post had an article on June 10th, I believe, 2004, in which the reporter admitted and reported that Alzheimer's is not going to be likely to benefit from stem cell research, and asked one researcher why he didn't, why he allowed people, it's very cruel when you think about it, allowed people with family members with Alzheimer's to believe that there was this cloning cure coming down the line. And the man said, quote, well, to begin with, people need a fairy tale. And this illustrates, A, the cruelty and callousness of some of these advocates, but B, how the science community has become completely ideological, not every scientist, but I'm talking about the establishment, and how they become politicized so that, you think a scientist will tell you the objective truth. Often these advocates are very ideological, and they're not telling you the objective truth. For example, they will say that cloning doesn't create a human embryo, it creates stem cells. That's false. I talked to one big politician who told me in big time, I mean, I'm talking a really big guy and a state, and he said that he had been told by biotech people that if you use a liver cell for cloning, what you get in the petri dish is a liver. And my response was, well, that's A, baloney, that's junk science, but B, Dolly the sheep was named Dolly because she was named after Dolly Parton, and they did that because they used a mammary gland, and Dolly Parton is big busted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you used a mammary gland to create Dolly, why didn't she come out as a breast? Of course she didn't. She came out as a sheep, because before she was a sheep embryo. And she was implanted, and she went through the gestation just like any other embryo and became a sheep, even though she had some health problems and defects. The same thing is true in human cloning. Human cloning, there aren't different kinds, like reproductive and therapeutic. There's only cloning. That creates a human embryo. That's a new human life. At that point, the only question becomes, what do I do with this life that's been created? If you implant it in a womb to make it a baby, it's often called reproductive cloning. But if you're going to use it for destruction and research, it's called therapeutic cloning. But it's the same
cloning. It's still cloning. It's still cloning, isn't it? Right. And I'll tell you, Wesley, it's it's been exciting to talk to you about this topic, and you're so passionate about it, and there are so many things that you put forth in these quick 25 minutes that we've been talking, and I just want to encourage people to go to his website, WesleyJSmith.com. Again, that's WesleyJSmith.com, and read through what he has there on his website, because there are so many different facets of everything we've talked about, everything from the Schiavo case to human cloning, what cloning is, who can really benefit, what is the moral and ethical significance of the things that we're talking about. This is such an important topic, and I sure appreciate your writings on this and your book. So I want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Wesley Smith. He's the attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. That's a must-have for this topic. Thank you very much, Wesley, for being with us.
Thanks, Mark. Good talking to you.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, I'll tell you, this is quite a topic, this whole issue of end of life or cloning. It really finally comes back to, what do we really believe about life? You know, there's two ways to look at this. Wesley Smith just did a fantastic job of going over some of the ethical realities, the medical realities, and boy, it does get deep. There are so many terms to deal with, and I just plead with Christians throughout the land to read up on these topics, because we are looking at the reality of what's taking place to human life, whether it's in the womb, in that time of life, or at the end of life. These life issues are so important to the community, to the whole world, not just to church and not just to Christians. But they're important to, how are we going to look at the weakest people in our land? How are we going to take care of those who are in need? Now, as Christians, how are we going to take care of and show love to our neighbor, especially the weakest neighbors, those neighbors who are in the womb, those neighbors who are in petri dishes, those neighbors who are just being written off as a product, something to farm? Boy, this is some real dangerous ground. And I just don't think, listening to parishioners and speaking with people, I don't think people fully realize the slippery slope we are on. And we are being conned. We are being conned by the general media, because they're not giving us what's really behind all these words. They're not telling us the reality of the human life that exists there. But for the Christian, the most important way for us to look at this is through Christ. Christ was conceived. Christ lived in Mary's womb. Christ was the one who came to this earth to die for our sins. And it is that same Christ that will teach us the most as Christians on what it means to be a true human being. So take a look at these things and look forward to looking at his site, and be with us tomorrow as we now go. We'll listen to Dr. Andrew Steinman of Concordia University in River Forest. He'll be talking about Scripture alone, and with James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.